The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast that surfs the web, takes the hits and digests them into chunks you can chew on. A brief skim around the net tells us that it's been a busy week of conferencing for the Digirati. At Emerging Technologies in San Diego, they developed an internet conscience, discussing web advocacy and charitable intentions. At CeBIT in Hanover, Germany, they went green. And heaven only knows what's happening in South by Southwest. Thankfully, Jemima Kish is on location deep in the heart of Texas and will be coming to us live with details later in the show. In the pod this week, The Observer's Jay Rayner, who will be dishing the dirt on his old mate Nick Denton from Gawker Media, Bobby Johnson's back from his month-long trip into the land of robots, and Charles Arthur joins us for another week to enlighten and entertain. Hello to you all.
Hi.
Hi there.
Bobby, is it true that you are writing a book on robots?
Well, I'm trying to write a book on robots.
Have you discovered
it's going
anything? Very
slowly?
Isn't that what you're meant to be doing in the month off?
Yeah. So, you know, I've done a tiny bit of work.
Anything of interest that's come out?
I'm just delving deep into Czech literature from the 1920s at the moment. So,
and Karel Kapek.
Indeed.
Sounds like a fantastic displacement activity from writing a book on robots.
Yes,
that's right.
Well, as well as the latest from South by Southwest and close-up on Gawker's founder and overlord, we've decided that actually is his title. Charles demands answers from targeted advertising controversialists. Form. Any remaining time that we might have will be padded out with news and your views from the blogs. Gadzooks, it's a packed show. Sit tight and let the waves of technology wash over you. Gawker Media holds the interactive throne in the USA. Under the watchful eye of the London-born, New York-based grand poobah, Nick Denton, the new media consortium has grown from a small-time, bedroom-based fanzine chronicling the gossip in New York's glittery media insiders into a network of blog sites that literally have the major media organizations in its thrall. The sharp-witted, always-on, occasionally muckraking commentary is fiercely observed by the American media. Denton is never afraid to break uncomfortable news stories, even if it means facing the wrath of some of the most powerful stakeholders in the world. Now, Jay, you recently interviewed Nick Denton, who's a personal friend of yours, I believe, for The Observer.
Yeah, we go back a very, very long way. I first met Nick when I was about 16. So 25 years. We're both 41. We're complete contemporaries. And have watched him over the years going on to the FT while we're trying to make careers in journalism, then leaving it all behind, being involved in First Tuesday, the internet poster child for the internet boom, then moreover.com, an aggregating site. And then there was this moment, I don't know, I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago when I was in New York and I said to Nick, what are you going to do next? And he told me all about blogging. And as an old media journalist, I listened to him and then shook my head and said, Nick, you're going to lose every penny. Because who wants to hear what people have to say? And who's going to look at this stuff? But what I don't think I understood when I was talking to Nick was how he was going to professionalize and commercialize blogging and how he was going to make a shed load of money. Perhaps not as much as the Sunday Times Rich List claimed, which is they valued him at £140 million. It is classic Denton to down-talk everything about the money and the revenue and all of that. But you can be certain that even if it's a tenth of that, he's worth a lot more than... How about all of us put together?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The hands down and twice over.
Exactly.
So do you think he is a visionary, or do you think that he was just happened to be in the right place at the right time?
The Nick I know has had a horrible ability to be in the right place at the right time all the way through his adult life. I mean, going back to his first splash, he happened to be in Hungary, stringing as a reporter, when the Romanian Revolution happened and he got on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. Now with the net, I think the thing is, and he put it pretty well to me when we were talking, he said that, you know, if you spend 8 to 10 hours of your adult life online every day, you're going to spot stuff that other people don't. I do think, though, he has a particular nose. He did once write a column for Management Today in which he said he hated the term visionary because visionaries are never very good at executing ideas. And he is very, very good at executing ideas.
I mean, it's the execution is the real thing, isn't it, with all the Gawker blogs, is they really get in there and they plug away. And if the last post wasn't that good, okay, well, there's another one coming up in a couple of minutes.
Exactly. He has found a way to make it work, actually, I think, on quite an old media model. You scratch away at Gawker Media, which has 15 blogs now covering everything from travel through technology, politics, you name it, it's there. And actually, the niches they're filling, the way the advertising strategy is built, even the hiring and firing strategy, is pretty old media. It just happens to have this tang of something very new to it.
You mentioned in the article, actually, that that the US media just is enraptured with what goes on in Gawker. You know, they're sort of clambering, and there's a lot of feedback, give and take, between anything that happens on Gawker, whether it's the home blog or, you know, any of the other blogs in the conglomerate. How much effect do you think he has internationally?
I think certain of the sites have international reach, but it is basically an American domestic thing. And Nick, who was on the Financial Times for 8 years, is very clear that it wouldn't work here, even though a few people have tried it, because our media, and this is a big one, let's give it up for the Brits, is so snarky and in your face already. There's nothing, I don't think, you'd find on Gawker or Defamer, the LA film blog, that you wouldn't actually find in The Guardian or The Observer or any number of the British papers. The US papers, the US mass media, the old media, is very po-faced. They're mortgaged to their noble calling.
Absolutely.
And they can't quite bring themselves to say this stuff. So there's Nick. There is a vacuum, and he's filled it brilliantly for America.
I mean, there are sort of sites like Paris Hilton, aren't they, which are the sort of the unfashionable face of fashion, which are amazingly rude about people all the time. But I mean, I guess the dent and touch has been to do it with this British approach, which, as you say, is not at all the American approach, where they can't unwind themselves from being so po-faced. Kara Swisher, that's right, the Wall Street Journal writes the All Things Daily blog. That sort of has, it unwinds a little, but it's still a bit sort of tight.
Well, Kara Swisher was one of the big people on Gawker at one point. So. Actually, all roads now lead to Gawker because Nick goes through bloggers like a 60-a-day smoker goes through fags. There are a lot of people from the Gawker school. Originally, when Gawker started, it was Elizabeth Spears, this gal who went on to Media Bistro and so forth. One woman, 12 posts a day. There are now 6 or 7 of them. They're spread out across America. He's got someone on the West Coast covering nights. And it's, you know, for all us old newspaper hands, it's starting to look suspiciously like an old-fashioned news operation.
So what about their pay-per-page impression model that they brought in quite recently? Because this has been a bit controversial in a lot of people, and I have to say I'm one of them in some respects, say that this is kind of dumbing down all of Gawker's blogs and driving them to the lowest common denominator.
Well, Gawker themselves said there was an internal memo, which I saw, and it said there is a suggestion that it leads us to trashy stories which get viewed more often. It's absolutely true, but it's the only measure we've got and we're going to use it. Nick does not claim any noble purpose. He says that occasionally, as with the most famous recent story, which was the video of Tom Cruise going on about Scientology, there is the smack of noble purpose. And he says, that's fine, I can take a bit of noble purpose, but I'm interested in eyeballs. He does say that he's always been accused of dumbing down from week 3 of Gawker. And it's, you know, that same thing they used to say about Punch magazine in the UK, yes, that it's never
as funny as it used to be.
And I think there's something to it, because I did read Gawker every day. I went back to it for this piece. And actually, it was the coverage of Obama, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in the election, which made me think, no, there's quite a lot of substance here. And people are still looking at it. They need 60, 70 posts a day on Gawker. Some of them are going to be complete fluff. Some of them are going to be a bit more substantial.
That is astounding, 60 to 70 posts a day. And I was going to ask you, because while I know you weren't involved with the top 50 blogs that were recommended with the Observer article, what as a blog watcher, what would you say makes a good blog? What should be on that list and why?
It's got to feed the addiction, hasn't it?
A good blog
is crystal meth. I'll just refresh one more time. Yeah. It's only a minute since I did the last time.
You might have posted in that time. So tell us, Jay, the scary question for the journalists sat around the table is, do you think this is the way forward, that the listeners are going to find that we are going to be too busy sort of, you know, writing and just got to do another blog post because that's how I'm being judged and this is how I'm going to get paid? Is this the future of our media?
Do you mean by that old newspaper journalists?
Newspaper journalists?
Well, I have a wider overarching view. I mean, I think you know that I blog quite a lot for The Guardian and The Observer, and that actually it's all about positioning writers as brands. And some of us are going to be premium brands and some of us are not going to be premium brands. If you're a professional...
I feel like the Tesco value brand at the moment.
Well, if you're we've got to have something to distinguish us if we've been journalists and professional writers for 20 years or 30, or however long it is. In my case, it's 20 years. We should be pretty good at it. We should be better at it than the majority of people who are blogging out there, which should mean that you are essentially a premium brand. So you just have to, I think, look after your little corner of the farm, as carefully as you possibly can.
Does that mean you'll get the page views automatically? Or do you think that it'll be driven where the newspapers will say, you know, this guy, you know, he may have been writing about it for 20 years, but he doesn't get as many page views as this person who's only been doing it for 5?
Let's whisper it. There are some of our colleagues who are quite dull writers who are not maybe great journalists. He may find the story better than anybody. But when you put them on that medium, the blogging medium, just can't hack it, can't work out how to do it, and it's never going to fly for them. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that they're not going to be a vital and useful part of any kind of news media operation, but the blogosphere may not be that accommodating to them. It does require a different skill set to make it work. Some of us will be all right at it, some of us will be rubbish at it.
Well, I'm unfortunately going to have to draw this to a close, but thank you very much, Jay, for coming in and spilling the beans about your former schoolmate, Nick.
My pleasure.
I think you will still be on the Christmas card list, though. There wasn't any sort of embarrassing situations that were discovered.
You never know with Nick Denton.
But you can check out more on Nick Denton and the top 50 blogs on observer.co.uk and on guardian.co.uk/technology. Now it's time for the news.
Apple boss Steve Jobs finally launched the iPhone Software Development Kit last week, allowing developers to create official iPhone applications that won't require users to hack their devices. Apple missed a self-imposed deadline to launch the SDK for the end of February, but the news coincided with the BBC's announcement that it was making videos on its iPlayer service compatible with the iPhone. NATO believes cyber terrorism now constitutes a major threat to global security. Speaking at the E-Crime Congress in London, NATO official Suleiman Anil said the organisation now treated the subject as seriously as missile defence or energy security. Peter Gabriel's latest online music venture has scored a coup after signing a deal with the world's second largest record label, Sony BMG. We7, which offers tracks for free by attaching adverts to them, will now be able to stream 250,000 songs from artists like Mark Ronson, Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. And talking of advertising, Google could be getting ready to bring its TV ad system to the UK. The scheme, which lets companies see how many people are watching their adverts, is currently being trialled in the US. And Google, which already has a partnership with BSkyB, said that it was looking at opportunities in Britain.
Thank you very much, Bobby. You look nice in Jemima's clothing. So tell me a little bit more about this e-crime conference, which sounds, to be quite honest, awesome. And I would have loved to have gone and seen what kind of crime was happening on e.
Yeah, well, it wasn't all that. But what was interesting really was Suleiman Anil was really just talking about the way NATO looks at the internet now and the way that these intergovernmental defence organisations have to think about cyber terrorism and espionage particularly. And we've seen things like the Titan Rain Chinese hackers, the strike in Estonia. Was it a government sponsored strike? Was it just a hacker who got a bit of a cob on?
We're
continuing to argue about that, but it's clear that even if cyber terrorism as an event or as a movement isn't actually that threatening, that you have to deal with the worst case scenario and prepare for it.
Which is, of course, why they've started to go into places like World of Warcraft to look for cyber terrorists. The other thing that I wanted to touch on a little bit was Google's TV ad system. What is that about? I've not heard anything about this.
They're working with the Dish Network in the US, which is a satellite broadcast network, much like Sky is over here, but far smaller penetration. What it allows them to do is put software inside your set-top box that checks what adverts you're actually seeing and feeds that back to the advertisers. The interesting thing, they've tried this, it's kind of, you know, the success rate isn't that great. And also they've tried moving into other offline products like pushing print advertising. None of these have been a huge success, but maybe they're where Google needs to go to get out of the internet ad market, which it already dominates.
It seems kind of strange to me that they would be going for something like this, because there's a lot of criticism about, in the States, Nielsen ratings or Barb ratings over here, because you could simply have the television on in the background. And one of the crucial and important things about the Google AdSense model is that you have to interact with it. You probably won't just leave something up. So how are they trying to cope with that? What's their model there?
Well, I think they're starting from a base level where the way they measure TV ratings at the moment is just awful from the start. You know, they don't have to do much to improve on it. So first of all, I think they're saying, okay, we can do that. They are also developing other technologies, but other ways of measuring exactly what's being watched and the way you interact with it. And, you know, if we're moving forward into the long-promised and never-quite-delivered interactive TV future, you can imagine they'd be in prime position to capitalise on that.
And very, very briefly, quickly touching on the iPlayer and iPhone story that you mentioned, because we will be talking about that next week.
Well, we've been waiting for the iPhone SDK for a while.
5 months, something
yeah,
like that.
And even before that, you know, everyone kind of wanted the iPhone to start off being open to developers. Not directly related to the SDK, but to the BBC's iPlayer announcement, was something over the weekend, which kind of revealed that they were sending out an MPEG-4 stream rather than the encoded flash streams that they use at the moment. What that means is if you get your computer to pretend to be an iPhone, which is possible, you can actually plug into the non-DRM stream straight out of BBC HQ.
And we're going to be talking more about that next week. We've got a longer interview with the BBC about their iPlayer and the iPhone. But that's enough from us about the news. You can read these stories and more on the website at guardian.co.uk/technology. Targeted advertising is the bane of online libertarians and those advocates who represent our digital privacy. But advertising software firm Form thinks they have a model that brings the lucre in for the companies, but also protects your digital rights. Charles, what's the story here?
Well, Alex, this has been red hot on the blogs all week. The idea is that Form will work with the ISPs BT, TalkTalk and Virgin Media. It'll put a cookie on your machine when you start a browsing session. That'll monitor what sort of sites you go to, what sort of things you like, build up a profile attached to that cookie, not the IP address. When you get to a page that has ads served by Form, it'll be tailored to your tastes. But there's been a big dispute over whether this invades people's privacy, whether they should be doing this. And Form has been on a real PR offensive. Kurt Ertegrul, who's the chief executive, offered to answer questions that have been asked on our blog, and he came in. I started by asking him how he sees the roles of ISPs. Should they be a trusted carrier of data or just another data set to be exploited by advertisers?
You know, I think that the bond of trust that the ISPs have with their customers is obviously their key consideration. So I don't think that there's anything at all that the ISPs would do to betray that trust. And I think this idea that what we offer is somehow detracting from that trust is actually the opposite. What this does is several things. Number one is it makes the internet a safer environment by protecting against online fraud in real time at the network level as they're browsing. And by the way, protecting the people who are least likely to have, for example, software that they're updating and keeping up to date.
You said the system's cookie-based, but how do you work around the fact that cookies are only sent back to an originating server?
We have a way of identifying the users, regardless of which website they're on, through the use of a cookie.
And you didn't say identifying the cookie, you said identifying...
No, identifying, sorry, apologies, identifying the cookie, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's rather unusual, isn't it?
I think the system that we've deployed is unusual and novel in every respect.
But that one's rather more unusual than I'd expect. Is that just doing it within BT's cache, or where is it doing this?
It's doing it within our system. So the cookie never actually leaves the system in any way. There's no cookie that's visible to the outside world.
So you're actually standing within the BT system entirely?
Yes.
And being worked into it?
But our servers, again, are within the BT network and controlled by BT.
When did you start working with BT?
Several years ago.
Several years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because Form used to be known as One-to-One Media. It was an entirely different company.
We were working with them when we were One-to-One Media.
What were you doing with them then?
Doing due diligence on this. What you see today is the product of the work we've been doing for at least a couple of years. That is why I think you'll find that when it comes to questions of privacy, this is not being taken lightly. We've literally built the system from ground up to make sure that this is groundbreaking in terms of privacy, because we understood that that was going to be the foremost consideration of users when we launched.
But Context Plus, which One-to-One Media used to provide as a download?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was one of your products?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Was identified by F-Secure as a piece of spyware?
The problem with the spyware adware connotation is that we've found it consistently difficult to get people to make the distinction between a legal adware application and a malicious spyware application. And for that reason, we decided unilaterally to discontinue that business altogether as a public company.
It was found to have been installing a rootkit, which makes it rather more than adware.
Well, we met recently with the FTC and a number of other people on this, and we've never, ever had any complaints at all. So I think I'm not really sure what you're suggesting.
For a lot of people, the problem is that form has come out of pretty much nowhere. I mean, after all, until last May, you were called One-to-One Media. And One-to-One Media had a...
But we were a publicly listed company known as One-to-One Media. So the idea that you would somehow list on the London Stock Exchange's AIM, and there's something strange about a change of name, I think is it says more about where you're trying to paint us.
So what was the purpose behind the change of name?
We thought that form was a better name. And we knew that we were going to be adopting a higher profile. We thought that One-to-One Media was a bit cheesy as a name, and we decided to change it then rather than now.
Okay. The problem I think that many people have is that from, you know, to them out of nowhere, because not many people
haven't done much publicity because we didn't have anything to be public about. We now have. From a privacy standpoint, this is a revolution because this is really an opportunity for consumers to square the tension that typically has existed between advertisers and consumers. It's always been believed that advertisers need large amounts of data in order to show ads. Our answer is don't give any data up at all and have a clear and transparent opt-out and make yourself completely anonymous. And just to be sure, bring in external validators. Bring in Ernst & Young. Bring in Privacy International. Bring in anybody you like.
It wasn't Privacy International, was it, though? It was Simon Davis and Gus Hosin who were acting individually.
Your point is what?
The point being that it's not Privacy International.
Your point is that Simon Davis somehow, when he puts on another hat, is someone completely different.
He is not Privacy International. Privacy International doesn't do examinations of products. It doesn't give approvals in that way.
What is the implication?
To say that Privacy International has looked at the work, A, isn't true, and B, gives it a false sort of sense.
Let's set aside Privacy International. Let's talk about Ernst & Young. That was actually Ernst & Young, and they performed a privacy audit, and they spent 3 to 4 months looking at the system. And you seem to be, strongly opposed to it. Now, explain to me, why is that?
I think it's more that people feel, actually, I was quite happy last week, and yet now this week I have the offing of this coming upon us, and if I don't like it, I have to opt out of it from my ISP.
Perhaps you were happy, but actually, if you poll users and you ask them, what is it that you're most unhappy about on the internet? They'll say two things. They'll say online fraud and dangers on the internet, and they'll say the amount of advertising they get bombarded with. The ISPs did a poll and asked users, what they thought. 80% of them really welcomed this.
Where was that poll made available?
I think we can probably provide you with a high-level result for that, yes.
It was done privately or it's...
It was done by the ISPs.
Do you know when it was done?
It was done... a few months ago.
Okay. And this was what, a sort of private poll for testing for the system?
It was an independent, properly conducted poll to evaluate what people thought of this.
Okay. So will people see fewer ads as a result?
Yes, we believe so. And why is that?
Do you mean fewer ads?
I mean literally fewer ads.
How will that work? How will there be fewer?
Why do you think that advertisers throw thousands of ads at you as you're browsing? Because they have no idea what your interests are.
That's not quite the case, is it? DoubleClick, for example, puts cookies on lots of people's machines.
I'm glad you raised that example, because if you right now look in your browser to see the cookie files that have been stored there, you'll see that perhaps literally hundreds of people have tracked your behavior as you've been browsing. And you never gave permission for that. There was never an on-off switch for that. You're essentially leaking privacy as you go along. If you try disabling your cookies, what you'll find is that the internet doesn't work anymore. All advertisers would like to be able to do is just show their ads to people who are interested in their products. So, again, if you're concerned about privacy and you're concerned about the amount of advertising that you see online, this is the best thing that's ever happened to you.
Well, Charles, as our producer Scott called that interview, he said it was robust.
Yeah, well, it was pretty interesting. There's a lot of questions that people want answered from form, and there's lots of things that people don't quite know why this was done or why it is they should have to opt out. I've been hearing today that TalkTalk, which is one of the three big ISPs that's looking to sign up with form, may be making theirs opt in rather than BT, which seems set to make it opt out. That would certainly certainly change the whole landscape, I think, certainly for TalkTalk customers. I've been doing some digging over the weekend. I couldn't find that poll that he referred to, but I did find an article that appeared on CityWire in 2006, where he said when TalkTalk launched their free broadband service that he could see the chance for targeted advertising. This is Kent Ogle. He said, you know, I was emailing everyone that day when they did it because I could see, you know, targeted advertising. That's going to be the way forward.
Yeah, I find this really interesting, and the phrases he was using as well, really intriguing. Saying stuff like, you know, the internet doesn't work without cookies.
Which is pretty much true, you have to say. If you block cookies, it is, but, you can hardly get anywhere.
But the assumption then being that, well, you don't want your cookies to give information to advertisers, but you're still giving information to ISPs. So, you know, it's still a form of your personal data being used by somebody else. And the idea that, you know, it's somewhere different in the chain doesn't really matter to ordinary people. It's the idea that these things might be able to connect the dots some way or use the information for a purpose which they haven't agreed to.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Charles. I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about that in the future. That was Kent Ertegruel from Form. The annual South by Southwest interactive event is currently underway in Austin, Texas, and our intrepid Jemima is on the scene to fill us in on what's happening. So what's the atmosphere like there, like out there, Jemima?
Oh, hi. It's, well, it's a bit tribal, actually. It's all of the world's finest geeks and tech-inclined people all gathering in one place.
So what are the tribes? Tell us, what tribes are there?
Well, there's the programmers, Chemos. There's the social networkers, yeah, maybe some chemo kids, I don't know. You know, it's not a place for deals, it's not a place for suits. This is a conference that doesn't cost $5,000 to get in. It's a conference that costs $250. And these are the real grassroots people, the people that build stuff, the people that use stuff, and the early adopters as well. So this is where a lot of companies want to be to, you know, prove that their stuff works and to get feedback on it. And the best thing really is what happens in the corridors, which is all the fascinating discussion around what's happening.
There's been a lot of publicity about the keynote, the Facebook keynote. Yes, and can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
To give it a bit of an autopsy, I think the interviewer, Sarah Lacey, knows Mark Zuckerberg fairly well, and they were out having dinner the night before. So she was very familiar with him, but she also comes from a very kind of businessy background. And so
she's a reporter for Business Week, isn't she?
Yeah, she wrote the very famous front cover story on Kevin Rose a while back. She has a tendency to make very rambling observations rather than asking direct questions. And he's a very difficult person to interview. He's very shy. And I think he needed somebody to press some very particular buttons. And that just didn't happen. And as a consequence, about halfway through the interview, I mean, there were strange things happening, like the conversation just sort of paused. And then he said, "Are you going to ask me any questions?" And she thought she was like finished. Ooh. I mean, the whole thing was like a really awkward date, which happened to have, you know, several thousand people watching it.
What sort of questions did they want her to ask him?
Well, you know, these are the people who want the nuts and bolts. You know, these are the people that build it. As soon as they opened questions to the floor, there were people asking, why has the email got so little functionality? You know, when are you going to open that up? When are you going to make it easier to search emails and stuff, or integrate the messaging systems? You know,
how does that compare to like the questions that she was asking him?
Well, she was asking sort of business strategy. You know, she was asking about the departure of the chief executive, and this audience is mostly a conference for developers, and they're not really interested in suits. There was another very uncomfortable moment where Sarah Lacey was supposed to prompt Mark Zuckerberg to talk about language versions so that he could announce the launch of Facebook in French. And instead, she kind of blew it by saying, "So I hear you're launching in French." And he was like, "Oh." And then she sort of had to stand up and apologise to the PR woman. It was just awful.
Moving on. Yes, this sounds horrible. What else have you seen?
Okay, so Henry Jenkins was absolutely brilliant. He set a really good tone before everyone forgot about him and was talking about Sarah Lacey instead. So he's talking about behaviours of kids and how that behaviour differs to their parents, and how parents instinctively reject new technologies and things because they don't understand them.
Remind me who Henry Jenkins is?
He's an MIT professor, quite a well-known author in kind of behaviour and cultural attitudes to things like technology and gaming and things, and saying that if you stay up all night reading a book, you're learning, but if you stay up all night playing a computer game, you're addicted. And we have these strange cultural prejudices that actually we need to overcome if we're going to progress and understand the very important kind of collective behaviours that we're moving towards. And then he gave a fantastic plug for Obama, actually, and saying that a lot of senior politicians use the language of I and you, and Obama very cleverly has tapped into the kind of Wikipedia generation, if you like, by using the language of we and us, and the campaign slogan, Yes, We Can, which is very, very interesting and a quite weighty endorsement.
One last thing that I wanted to touch on was the video services. That seems to be really booming at South by Southwest.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been talking to lots of people about what they're looking at and what they've been playing with, because if you're ever going to be in a place where people are really kind of playing with exciting tools, then this is it. And last year, Twitter really took off because there were lots of people using it to organise meetups and tell other people what was going on. So there were loads of people playing with video stuff. So I've been playing with Seismic, I've been playing with Kite, and they're all quite interesting, very fast to turn around kind of video distribution services. And so Kite yesterday, they're quite clever. They've got all bases covered, really. You can record a clip on your phone or on your webcam, publish it on the site, and then you can view it on your mobile, or you can embed it in your blogs or your social networking sites and stuff. And it's really making video that much more accessible and easier to communicate. But it's very early days. It would be interesting to see what this stuff does when it grows up a bit, because it could almost be used for kind of any application at the moment. Like music businesses are starting to look at this, encouraging the direct relationship between artists and their fans, which is fascinating, really.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jemima. I'm afraid to all the listeners that the elevator is out of service. When are you coming back, Jemima, next week?
I'm actually not back for 2 weeks now, but I'll be back after Easter.
But we'll hear more from you next week, won't you?
Yes.
Won't we? Excellent. All right. Expect more from South by Southwest next week, and there's continuing coverage at blogs.guardian.co.uk/digital content. And speaking of blogs, what's been going on in the ether this week, Charles?
Very briefly, just for a little blip on Friday, I looked into the question of whether the Beatles songs are going to go onto iTunes. The London Evening Standard had their front page piece on this, which was about how Paul McCartney would get £200 million as all the Beatles stuff went onto iTunes. But I have to say, I've been following this story about whether Apple Corps, which owns the rights to the Beatles music, will ever actually go onto, you know, the iTunes store or wherever, since about 2003. And I've been ringing up Apple Corps, you know, pretty much once every 6 months, saying, are you going to have the music on iTunes? They say, no dates yet. And although the Evening Standard was very confident of their sources, I rang Apple Corps, who said, still haven't sorted it out, actually. When they do go online, if they ever do go online, then very likely it's going to be a big payday, because there'll be all the people who want to buy the Beatles stuff online. No doubt, you know, they'll manage to have two number ones 4 decades apart, because downloads now count towards the number ones. But I suspect that what's happening is that Apple Corps, you know, people who own the Beatles music rights, are holding out for just a little bit more money, and that's what's holding it up.
But it was really interesting watching the kind of the news meme, because the Daily Mail, which is the Standard's sister newspaper, reported basically the exact same story on Saturday, and suddenly it propagated everywhere. But everybody's reporting it as fact. And I think when you watch those things spread, you kind of, whew, it's very interesting. I've got a comment from Jemima's PDA blog, which refers to the top 50 list that was put out from someone called Just Thinking, saying they were wondering why the Drudge Report was on there, because according to them, it's not a blog. He doesn't syndicate his site to RSS and he doesn't open it up to comments. Now, that I thought was kind of interesting, because some people seem to have a really specific idea of what constitutes a blog. Someone from Gawker actually tried to give me a bit of a pasting for not having comments on my personal blog. The reason I don't do that is because I haven't got time to waste, you know. But it's kind of what constitutes a blog these days. I think it's such an amorphous term that it's kind of slightly pointless.
You don't need to have comments on a blog. This is a point that's been made many times over. I mean, John Norton on The Observer in his column pointed this out. He said, yeah, you know, the blog is something where I write and you can read, and if you want to comment on it, you know, get a blog yourself.
I remember back then when it were all fields, there weren't even commenting systems at all. You know, but Alex, you've got
to send them a letter.
I do, yes.
You?
Well, I was going to say some of the nice things about blogs is that you get amusing comments. Yeah. Not always, but sometimes you get amusing comments. And last week, the founder of Dungeons and Dragons, Gary Gygax, died after a long illness. And there were some quite amusing, very, very, very geeky comments about his passing. Skins writes, "So long, Gary, you've thrown a one and gone to the great dungeon in the sky. Have fun and don't forget the D&D mantra. Find the monster, kill the monster, take the monster's treasure." This was the one that was the most popular. Hackney Badger writes, "Here lies Gary Gygax. He failed his saving throw."
Excellent.
I don't know what any of these things mean, but...
Come on.
No, I'm standing down. I'm taking off my orc wear.
I can guess what it means. I've never even played D&D.
I'm not even going that far. And then finally, Aurelia wrote, "R.I.P. Mr. Gygax, Lord of Prime Requisites." Who knows what that means, but see, this is...
I know, but I'm not telling you.
You are a big geek. Anyway, thank you very much to everyone for your comments and your thoughts. If you've not already taken part in the interactive dialogue, because really, that is what a blog is about.
Not necessarily.
I don't know. Feel free to join in at the fun at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/digital-content/games, where we do accept comments. Thank you very much.
I'm James Randerson, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, as researchers develop a computerized mind-reading technique, we look into the mind's eye of our special guest, the brain and cognition scientist Dr. Martin Monti. Also in the show, we hear from Professor John Beddington, the UK government's new chief scientific advisor. Plus, we'll discuss ESA's latest launch, hear from Sweden's only astronaut, and shoot down in flames the Chris company that's hoping to advertise in space. It's all on our new Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
We're almost out of words for this week, but before we go, Charles, what can we expect from the paper on Thursday?
We're looking at the very many ad-funded models that there are out there for newspapers. Obviously, people find them littering the streets all the time, but also for mobiles, for music, for all sorts of possible future techniques. We're looking at an RFID tagging experiment in the University of Washington where people had RFID tags that would tell you where your mobile phone charger or your wallet, and of course, where your friends were all the time. We have an interview with Dean Hachemovich, who's the general manager of Internet Explorer at Microsoft. In Freer Data, we're talking to Tom Watson, who's the cabinet minister who's going to be in charge of implementing the Power of Information report. And we have a report from Tech08. We also have a technophile looking at the MyView glasses, which lets you walk around watching stuff that's on your iPod. Beware lampposts.
Thank you. And on next week's Tech Weekly, we'll be getting to grips with the relationship between the BBC's iPlayer and Apple's iPhone, as well as other many splendid things. You can catch all that from Tuesday, available to download from guardian.co.uk/audio. Thanks as ever to our pod partners, Bobby, Charles and Jay, and special thanks to Jemima for getting up in an early hour to report to us from Texas. To our guests, and also hello to our producer Scott over there in the box. I'm Alex Kratowski, and we'll see you again next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.